Before we discuss the topics for the lab exam, there are a lot of questions that have come up in class and in office hours about how to do the dilution calculations for the kinetics lab. So, if you think about dilution, not thinking about the specific chemicals involved, because I think a lot of the confusion is coming from the fact you have so many different substances, different concentrations, different reactions. But what is dilution? How much of the solution did you use versus what did the total volume end up being? Like if you, to think simple numbers, if you double the volume, then the concentration goes down by half. And you can work out a more complicated example where if you say, starting with 50 milliliters of a stock solution that is diluted to 100 milliliters, what would happen to the concentration of the solution? Well, 50 milliliters going to 100 milliliters, that's double the volume. That's why you're going to get half the concentration. So that same relationship, how much solution did you use? I think I called that V used everywhere. And that meant how much of the particular reagent did you use? Then divided by the total solution volume, which was 1.9 milliliters in every case. In that case, then, it doesn't matter which substance you throw into the equation, because if I recall, both the iodide and peroxydisulfate have the same stock concentration of 0.2 molar. So that means no matter which trial, which reaction, which substance, if the original concentration was 0.2 molar, then that means that if you use 0.8 milliliters, it's going to be 0.842 molar. If you use 0.4 milliliters, it's 0.0421 molar. If you use 0.2 milliliters, it's 0.021 molar. And then I guess 0.1 milliliters is 0.01 and change. Not remembering the numbers because I'm not looking at them. I've just seen them enough lately that I remember some of them without looking. So again, that's just not dependent on which substance in that case, because it's all the same initial stock concentrations and because it's all the same total solution volumes. So anywhere you got 0.4 milliliters on those tables for those two reagents, everywhere it's going to be the same concentration. Hopefully that helped clarify a lot of the questions that some of you may have. Let us now review the topics for the lab exam, which I want to be careful to call this the lab exam and not the lab final, because final makes you think that something's going to happen during finals week, and the thing that's given during finals week is only related to lecture material. So in reverse, this lab exam will have no lecture-only material. Now, that means that if we had a discussion, for example, like bonding and antibonding, obviously that didn't show up anywhere in the labs, so that whole entire topic can be ignored for purposes of lab exam. Really, the only reason that I went over it the way I did is to help some of you out that might be in 1C, or in the increasingly likely case that I will be teaching Chem 12A in the fall. I'm just trying to make your life easier because this is the very first thing that we do in our hurry in that class when I teach it. And I believe the other instructors are pretty similar in the approach, too. So, getting to the lab topics. This morning, I flipped through all the different lab notes, and so I've already compiled a list of the things that I identified that really are lab-related, the most detailed of which would likely be the molar volume of a gas lab. So molar volume of a gas at STP. So I know that we talked about what kind of reaction that was, the fact that it's a redox reaction. That is something I'm not going to ask about because that was more just to get us discussing, because that was one of the first times we all met as a class. And we talked about what ideal gases are, for example, but that really is more of the lecture bent to the topic. So something more specifically related to lab is when we would discuss the equation, the reaction equation, besides identifying that it's a redox reaction, we also identify the limiting reagent, because that controls how you approach the calculations, the stoichiometry. And even though we didn't talk about, or even though I said ideal gases themselves as a concept is not directly on the lab exam, I would expect you to be able to answer, why did we use hydrogen gas? Because if you did that in large enough quantities, that might be considered a hazardous thing. Well, the answer is, it acts very much like an ideal gas. That's why it was used. That's the short answer, but I'm just trying to demonstrate where the focus is going to be on the question. It'll be more about why is it that H2 was chosen than specifically what is an ideal gas. Now, you might want to know the experimental setup. Just because you will still, even if it's open note, be able to need to be able to handle the calculations. Suppose I give you a very straightforward, non-tricky set of data. Then presumably you would still need to be able to come up with an answer based off that data, and it helps if you remember, even if you didn't do it in real life, how the experiment was set up. So that's some of the theory, and then obviously you're going to need to be able to handle, like I just said, the calculations. And here, the most important thing is, and this is why we're delaying, so that those people that I never gave the comments to for their corrected lab reports, one of the problems that happened in everybody's lab reports, a lot of the lab reports, I should say, is not understanding how to incorporate the height difference. And that's because the lab handout doesn't have that equation, even though it has a data spot for it. And so a lot of people use the equations in the lab handout, not the ones that I gave in class. So I'm just broadcasting. You might want to go back and review that whole discussion of the height difference, how it shows up in the lab calculations, if that was something that confused you before. That is it in terms of specific topics that we discussed in the lab. So, does anyone have any questions about that first lab experiment? Then, the next lab was enthalpy of vaporization. Now, I forget where chronologically this happened. I know somewhere around the same time as maybe where we talked about atomic orbitals. It wasn't long after that that we did delocalization. Again, those were purely lecture topics, so that's why I'm not including them in all at this list. And that's why I don't even remember where they show up. So just trying to reassure you, focusing only on lab. So enthalpy of vaporization, that's the lab that had ethanol. Another thing that is for the students in the future getting ready for organic chemistry or 1C, we talked about line structures. Line structures will not be part of the lab exam. Again, if you end up in organic chemistry, you use line structures essentially from day one onward and never to return. So the main thing I will focus on here are the numerical calculations. You might say, well, numerical calculations, isn't that redundant? Like multiple repetitive redundancy? Let's see, numerical calculations. What I'm trying to broadcast there is you don't need to be able to create a graph. I'm not going to give you a data set to create a graph to include with your lab quiz. But the manipulations of your data that led up to that point, that I still want you to be able to understand. And what I mean by that is the following. You began your experiment with an empty container. that you would have put this probe attachment system onto with a valve open initially so that in the physical sense that system could come to equilibrium, and then you would close it off. And so there's a certain amount of air trapped in there that would be at a certain temperature and pressure. Now, you then add the ethanol, and so that's an increase in the total, would not necessarily be an increase in the total pressure. So it depends on how carefully you did the volume removal and addition, which we didn't do that in real life. But anyways, point is, we only care about what that vapor pressure of the ethanol itself is, not what the total pressure is. So we can simply subtract out that reference air pressure that's measured at the very beginning. The only problem being that if you change temperature of the system, then the air pressure itself would change, even if that's all that was in the container. So you had to do a PV over T equals PV over T style problem in order to adjust for the fact that we had changed to different temperatures. And then you could subtract those air pressures out from the total pressure, and that gives you the vapor pressure of ethanol. And so that's what I mean when I refer to the numerical calculations. Now, I guess along with the first experiment, because it helps to understand that process of preparing the flask, having it open, then closing it, then measuring it, then adding the ethanol, it would be good to know the experimental setup. You'll find, for the most part, I'm trying to avoid questions that depend more on having that kinesthetic, that hands-on touch experience in lab. I'm trying to avoid those while still addressing the things we directly talked about in lab lecture. So a big topic of discussion was spectroscopy. Now, some of it's very much 1A discussion that we did. So, for example, I'm not going to ask you about what are the different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum, since you would all just copy them straight out of the notes anyways. I have to relate a story just in case it brings a smile to somebody's face, because someone from my other class that I'm teaching, the organic chemistry class, was taking an exam, came to office hours, asked a very honest, perfectly legitimate question, and he didn't realize that the answer was literally, right there in one of the day's notes. There's so many notes that he must have just missed it. And he was banging his head over it. It's like, okay, everybody deserves a break. It's like, what? You mean like on page blah, the May blah notes? And you heard this kind of, from the other side of the screen, because he just realized his instructor went crazy and basically told him where the answer was. And while he was still kind of going, the next person logged in and they had the same question. It's like, what, you mean it's on page blah and the main blah notes, and just waited for the same 1, 2, 3, just like that. So the point of the story is, I'm not going to ask you about the different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum, since you all will just copy that part of the notes anyways. So what was more important? Well, what is spectroscopy? Meaning, why does light get absorbed? And I'll say correct energy, photons. Because that's the simplified way of saying it. Now, I'm not going to specifically ask about atomic spectra. But I gave a short discussion of atomic spectra to remind you of the fact that in systems like atoms, electrons have very specific energy levels, and they can change energy levels, but only between those specific levels. So then you only have very specific energy changes, which can be caused, therefore, by very specific types of photons, the ones with the right amount of energy that matches that gap between the energy levels. So that's what I mean about right energy photons. Light passes through a sample, and if it's got the right energy photons, that will excite some difference in energy levels. And not necessarily electrons. Nuclei or other things can get involved as well. But if you got the right amount of energy, it gets absorbed. Physically, how does spectroscopy work? It's very simple. Light passes through a sample. That sample may or may not interact with the light, and whatever does not interact will pass through and get detected by some kind of detector. Very simple. One of the key discussions we had was about lambda max. In other words, this wavelength of maximum absorbance. And if you can recall, that is something that's determined by taking a substance, measuring it all these different wavelengths, and find where is it more responsive to light. And so that's what the wavelength of maximum absorbance means. And the reason we care about it is if we're going to look for something, why not look for it where it's actually responsive so that we can be able to more accurately detect it. And that's exactly what we did. Now, morning section, if you're listening to this, one very important concept that I forgot to write down on the list is after we get the lambda max, then we use Beer's law. At least that's what we did in the labs that we discussed this quarter, because we're looking for concentration of a substance, and we did that by using spectroscopy. So remember that Beer's law is where absorbance is directly proportional to three variables. One variable that describes how sensitive the compound is to that wavelength or frequency of light, and that would be the extinction coefficient. Concentration would be another variable, and then path length, how far did light travel through the sample. Those were the highlights of spectroscopy. Let me pause again and ask any questions over what we've talked about so far.
I didn't really understand how the numerical calculations would work.
That means everything excluding the graph. That's everything excluding the graph for that experiment. So you have where at the end you're supposed to take the natural... what I was saying is that at the end of the calculations, you're supposed to create a graph that is a natural log of K versus 1 over temperature. But numerical calculations means everything else.
All right.
Any other questions? All right, then, moving on, we did discuss the green salt experiment. We did not end up going over the calculations. So there's a lot of the green salt that I don't want to ask about, especially because we didn't do it. And what I mean by that is the discussion of recrystallization. That's something that really helps to see and to do to have a better understanding of. So there are only two things that I'm going to end up asking about. Actually, only one thing. Okay, two parts of one thing. This is the analysis of oxalate. The reason I'm not doing the iron portion is I already have other topics on this list that deal with spectroscopy, which is that's what I'm more interested in, is the spectroscopy. The hydrate portion of the experiment. Well, you already did a hydrate lab and probably had lab quiz questions on hydrates last quarter in 1A. So don't feel like bulking up the exam here needlessly. So the one portion that we did talk about that I'd like you to still then review is the analysis of oxalate. And I would say by titration. So we discussed what a titration would occur, and the most important detail of that was the difference between the equivalence point versus the end point. The equivalence point is where you have equal moles, according to stoichiometry, that have participated in a reaction. The end point is instead some observation, some visual clue that the process is completed, that the titration is over. So, these are the only two things that I will ask about from the green salt experiment. So that leads us only two other things that would be on the lab quiz at all. One would be the iodine clock experiment. Which is the kinetics experiment. Now there won't be any real calculations. Because you're already spending enough time on this lab report trying to do the calculations. And it doesn't make sense to turn around and do it right again just practically the next day on a lab quiz, a lab exam. So you won't have to do any discussion about the calculations, but you do need to be able to discuss the theory. And specifically that means you need to be able to discuss why are there three different reactions. So there's one reaction that we're directly studying the rate law for. There's a second reaction that allows the solution to turn colors at the right point. But, and I might have said it incorrectly in the past, when the color change in this lab occurs, that's not really when the reaction is stopped. That's not when it ceases to react. That's just when we stop timing the reaction. And that's due to reaction 2, the one that involves thiosulfate. Thiosulfate reacts with and destroys the product of the reaction we're studying. That product of the reaction we're studying would turn the mixture colors if it met with starch. But before it has the chance to meet with starch, it reacts with the thiosulfate, gets reduced, and therefore the reaction fails to turn colors. So, once you run out of thiosulfate, the reaction's still going. And so it produces triiodide as a product, which interacts with starch, which creates the color. But just to say it again, that would be the point which we stop timing the reaction. But to be fussy about it, that is not when the reaction stops. But what I just discussed was the reaction we're studying, the reaction that controls stoichiometry, and the reaction that allows visualization. Those are the three reactions. And that was one of our definite large points of discussion during the lab lecture. So the last thing that that leaves us with is the equilibrium constant lab. I guess one would question a set of notes that have ice and beer in the same line of it there. But the point of saying that is the following. You are calculating an equilibrium constant, not the other way around. And you're using spectroscopy to come up with one of the items that's in the ice problem, which is, namely, how much product gets formed. So many ice problems involve starting with a K value, solving for concentrations. But we have discussed an easier problem that involves having the end result and then backing up to an equilibrium constant. So Beer's law is there because it gives us the concentration of the product, which then lets us solve for the equilibrium constant by doing an ice problem. So obviously that means that you're going to need to be able to perform the calculations, which I went through a set of example calculations when I described that lab.